Welcome to the HealthLinks podcast, presented by the HealthLinks family of services. I'm your host, DJ Thatcher. Our mission here is to engage in conversations about the medical, health, and wellness landscape of South Carolina so that we're all better informed. In this episode, we're joined by Dr. Chuma Obinime from the Palmetto Primary and Specialty Care Physicians. He is a gastroenterologist, and we'll hear more about that. Dr. Obinime, welcome to the HealthLinks podcast.
Thank you for having me, DJ. Pleasure to be here.
You are part of the network of the Palmetto Primary and Specialty Care Physicians, which really encompasses many of the medical specialties that we see. Of course, you're coming to us from the Division of Gastroenterology. Hey, tell our audience, they probably have an idea of what gastroenterology is, but hey, give us the formal definition of that, if you would.
Our office actually encompasses both gastroenterology and hepatology. So everything from basically your mouth, your anus, and then the liver, pancreas included, really. So we really just deal with all disorders of the digestive tract. I think, you know, when it comes to me and my kind of niche, I'm more on the motility side of things between me and the other two partners in my practice. But that's the overall what we kind of cover.
Now, we have a statewide audience here, and of course, your practices are in the Lowcountry here. Where are your locations in which you practice?
There's a number within Palmetto Primary Care, but where I practice is mainly, we have a clinic in the Nexton office, and then also at, it's right across from Trident Medical Center. Mm-hmm. It's the Medical Arts Building. That's where I have clinic as well. And then I do my procedures really between Somerville Medical Center and the Charleston Surgical Center. What is nice is that you kind of were doing this interview, I think perhaps 2 weeks before our new ambulatory surgical center opens in Nexton.
Yes.
It's the Nexton Procedure Center, brand spanking new, gonna have three, you know, endoscopy rooms. It's gonna be humming. So, you know, it's really exciting. We're gonna offer another, you know, site for our patients to get procedures done.
That Nexton area is growing tremendously, and yet it's such a convenient location, especially for people who are coming from other areas of the state, coming into the Lowcountry, and of course for those who live here as well. So good for you. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful area.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a moment ago about procedures, and I guess when we think of GI, gastroenterology, and so forth, people are thinking about the colonoscopy, but there's a whole lot more that you do. And give us an idea of some of the procedures you specialize in.
As I've been doing procedures and stuff, I've been getting a lot of questions about what would make you go into gastroenterology? And I really fell into GI more from the esophagus perspective. Mm-hmm. Some of my early mentors who really kind of taught me the ropes of GI were actually, one was actually a hepatologist, at Maryland, and then the other was Dr. Anand Jain. He showed up at Emory during the end of my residency, and we started doing research together. And you know, it was a really great relationship for the 4 years that we were kind of working together. So
sure.
Procedure-wise, yeah, I do I do the normal colonoscopy stuff, which I'm sure people are familiar with, but I also do upper endoscopies, which is you know placing a scope into your mouth and then going into the esophagus, stomach, small bowel, but also really some complex, esophageal, dilations for patients who have difficulty swallowing. When it comes to motility, some of the other procedures are really, we call them manometry-based procedures.
Mm.
Really, these are procedures that use pressure sensors to really understand different organs, specifically the esophagus and the rectum, and better understand how they function. When it comes to GERD, reflux testing,
mm-hmm.
we do a little more in-depth reflux testing, and then we do some more complex dilations in patients who have difficulty swallowing too.
You know, you're really affecting people with the quality of life, aren't you? You know, either and that you're talking about some of these conditions that people have, it really does affect their everyday living, doesn't it?
These are symptoms that they've been living with for a very long time, but don't want to really talk to anyone about, or just they've been finding their own ways to get by with these diseases. Like, I mean, I just diagnosed a gentleman with, eosinophilic esophagitis, which is kind of like an allergic kind of inflammatory condition of the esophagus, where over time, because of the development of, inflammatory cells, the esophagus essentially becomes scarred and fibrosed and doesn't work anymore. But these guys will come in and they'll say, "Oh yeah, I always, am the last one, like first one at the table, last one to leave, grind up my food, 30, 45 minutes after everyone's left, and just hoping and praying that food doesn't get stuck or I don't have to go to the bathroom and then bring it back up in order just to be able to get through my meal."
Sure.
It's always surprising me, like what, great lengths we go through to kind of compensate for some of the issues we're having.
Expand for a moment, if you will, some of the signs or symptoms that people might be just living with. They're putting up with it. Maybe they don't even realize that there is a treatment or a cure for some of the things they're dealing with. What do you see primarily?
I think, when it comes to the esophagus, the most common things are difficulty swallowing, so anytime that a patient tells me, they have difficulty with large pills or difficulty with solid foods, or even, I really get concerned when people tell me they have difficulty with liquids, that's really a concerning symptom. But, whenever someone tells me that, they eat food and they have to do some kind of maneuver in order to get it down, or the apprehension around eating certain foods like steak, chicken, pork, or even breads that get really dry. Those are the some of the common things that people will tell me. It's also interesting too, for a lot of people think that the esophagus is just for, swallowing food, but it's also actually really important for the clearance of acid. So a lot of what people will tell me too is, like, they think they have reflux, which is classically like burning behind their, sternal bone, or feeling like food wants to come back up. And they feel like these reflux symptoms aren't either are worsening all of a sudden, or they're not really responding to their typical Tums or over-the-counter medications. And actually, the esophagus is really important for, clearing the esophagus from its acid, because if you can't clear acid from the esophagus, the acid sits there, it can actually continually damage the esophagus and then lead to all sorts of other problems, whether that's worsening difficulty swallowing or even, precancerous.
A lot of people have, like you said, have that burning in the chest and so forth, and probably the first thing they think of, "Hey, am I having a heart attack?" I guess the symptoms are very similar, and yet obviously the treatments are drastically different. So someone who's experiencing that type of thing, can they refer themselves directly to your practice? Do they have to go through a primary care physician otherwise, or how does that work?
I think the vast majority of the patients that we see do come by way of their primary care doctor, just because sometimes it's, their PCP has started anti-reflux therapies, and, either it didn't work at all, or maybe it worked a little bit in the beginning, but now it's starting to really, get out of hand. Or I see patients who, have been self-referred, because, they've been dealing with this issue for a while, and, they really, maybe they're, read about me, read about the condition, or both, and, really want to have a better understanding of, what is actually going on. I think,
Sure.
especially with the esophagus, I've seen that a lot is that, I think patients, while they want to feel better, I think a lot of them have a desire to really understand, what's actually happening to them, because they know that they're what's happening to them is abnormal, and it shouldn't be that way.
Prioritize your health with a subscription to HealthLinks magazine. Get every issue of HealthLinks delivered right to your door for only $15.99 a year. Six issues packed full of local factual health information to help you be the best version of yourself in 2024. Subscribe now to HealthLinks magazine. Visit subscribehealthlinks.com. That's subscribehealthlinks.com. HealthLinks magazine, the Low Country's prescription for well-being. You're watching the Health Links podcast.
Now, of course, you're a gastroenterologist. You specialize in the gastrointestinal side, but you also mentioned the hepatic or liver side as well. And two questions. One is it common for people in your specialty to be a specialist in both? And secondly, especially for our lay public, what is the relationship between the liver and the GI tract?
Most people who go through gastroenterology fellowship training are going to be trained in both. There is, more advanced training if you want to be, credentialed in transplantation, like liver transplantation, that you need to go through. But all gastroenterologists have a really good foundational understanding of the liver and kind of the diseases that affect it. I think in most cases, you know, I think of them as separate, but there is overlap between, you know, diseases of the liver and diseases of the GI tract. Usually when we think about liver disease, of what we're seeing, you know, I think the major thing we're seeing is really fatty liver disease, which is really a burgeoning health crisis, to be honest. Fatty liver has now kind of, the nomenclature has changed a little bit because we've tried to really drill down fatty liver that's perhaps from alcohol, or, and then that fatty liver that could be related more to lifestyle factors like hypertension, heart disease. So now it's really called metabolic associated dysfunction, steatosis of the liver. It has a kind of evolved in that nature. You know, there's a number of diseases that kind of cross over in both.
We have our challenges in South Carolina. It's a beautiful place to live. We love it here. From a medical standpoint, we've got a lot of diseases. We top the list or near the top of the list across the country. And what are you seeing now? I know you've trained in other areas. You're relatively new to South Carolina. What are you seeing here, differences in just the population or the diseases that you're seeing between South Carolina and other areas where you've practiced?
I think here, you know, I think there's definitely, when it comes to, I think fatty liver disease is major, especially, you know, because it has, you know, this relationship with hypertension, type 2 diabetes, hyperlipidemia. Sure. So that's really been a major one. I will say that the nice thing about the practice is that in addition to kind of the standard ways that we evaluate patients with fatty liver disease, we also use something called a FibroScan. So it's really a non-invasive test that can really determine if someone's, you know, liver disease is really due to fatty liver or if it's due to something else. And I mention that only because, you know, a lot of times, you know, while it is very common, I think sometimes people will get labeled with fatty liver before having like the full workup for it. Seen a lot of that. I have seen more EOE, more eosinophilic esophagitis, I think definitely that I saw in Atlanta. I want to say colon cancer too. I mean, it has been really, you know, shocking to me, you know, the number of patients who, you know, have had, you know, chronic, you know, abdominal issues, whether that be abdominal pain or even, you know, lady with diarrhea, who are found to have, you know, colon cancer. And it'll be, you know, an individual who this is their first, you know, screening exam in their mid 60s. Those have been the most, you know, frequented and disorders that have surprised me.
And besides alcohol use, what else can people do to help both their liver and their GI tract just to stay healthy?
I think when it comes to the liver, I think the most important thing in patients who are doing well, you know, is to really think about the risk benefits of doing anything. You know, we know like keeping a balanced diet. I think there's been a lot of research around the Mediterranean diet when it comes to, you know, limiting the amount of fat deposition in the liver, you know, weight reduction in cases, physical exercise, all those things I think are great. I'm always, you know, hesitant to tell patients about like adding necessarily supplements only because some of those are quite unregulated, and it's hard to know exactly what's in them, what's not. Now, in my patients who do have fatty liver disease, where we know there's significant fat deposition, and that fat deposition, you know, over time is going to lead to liver scar and cirrhosis, I think it is prudent to be a little more hands-on with the approach. So I think in those cases, you know, we know if you lose 7 to 10% of your body fat and you have steatosis in the liver that's, you know, due to fat, you can actually completely reverse the excess fat that's in the liver and then some of the inflammation that may come as a result of it. There's also been studies around, you know, coffee consumption when they compared individuals who drank around 4 to 5 cups of coffee versus those who didn't. Those who drank coffee actually had less fibrosis in their liver than those who didn't.
It's a debate in our house. I'm not a coffee drinker. Can't even stand the smell of it. My wife loves it, so it'll be ammunition for her.
Yeah. Right, exactly. There's a couple of different medications that we always get concerned about. I mean, Tylenol is great, for when you have pain and, aches and things like that, headaches. Taking any more than 4 grams within a 24-hour period can certainly lead to damage of the liver, which we don't want. And then in those folks, who once their liver disease may start progressing, we also think about ibuprofen and any NSAIDs, not for the damage to the liver, but actually for the damage to the kidneys. There are some new drugs in the pipeline that, people are starting to prescribe for fatty liver. But I guess I'm kind of waiting to see a little more data on some of these.
Well, thank you for the advice. Great advice. One of the big elephants in the room, of course, is the recommendations for colonoscopies. I imagine that's why a lot of people hesitate in maybe getting a consult because of everything regarding that, the prep and the procedure and so forth.
Yeah.
Critics would say, hey, why is that necessary every few years if the medical community doesn't recommend a full body CAT scan every few years to find a tumor or a cardiac catheterization to see if there's any heart disease? Where did the recommendations come from? And first of all, what are the recommendations today? And also, what other alternatives are there with the Cologuard and the maybe some of the blood tests and other innovative approaches?
In 2021, the American College of Gastroenterology put out basically new recommendations for colon cancer screening. They dropped the age from 50 to 45. That was primarily because while, we actually have in the last few decades seen the mortality rate from colon cancer in older folks go down, we've actually seen the prevalence of colon cancer in patients younger than 50 actually go up.
Where is that right now as far as the leading cancers? Is that second, third? I can't recall.
It is. I want to say it's the fourth leading diagnosed, but then it's the second leading cause of death.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. When it comes to for cancers. Yeah. So we've seen it go up in younger individuals. So we, that's why they decreased basically the when they'd start screening from 50 to 45. The other big question everyone's asking is what is leading to the increase in colon cancer among that younger age? I don't even say it's $1 million question. It's probably $1 billion question.
Okay.
We think it's, lifestyle things as, the increasing risk of obesity, Western diet, lifestyle changes, sedentary lifestyle. We think that's what it's caused by, but we're not exactly sure. The big question is, why colonoscopy over the other ones? And then what are the other options? I think I'll just give you an overview of the options. Okay. So
sure.
Colonoscopy we have, which is really, you're talking to a gastroenterologist. So I say it's the gold standard.
Right.
Because it's the only test where you can look and treat exactly what you see. And hopefully remove polyps that are eventually going to turn into cancer as opposed to finding cancer. So I'll say there's colonoscopy. There's the stool-based tests in that you really have FIT and Cologuard. So the way to think about FIT and Cologuard is FIT really is kind of, a test wasn't really developed for colon cancer screening because really what it does is that you give a sample and it looks for essentially blood and then some abnormal DNA in your stool. Cologuard does the same. They just do, they just look for more different kinds of DNA changes in your stool. There's also ColoSense, which is similar again, but instead of looking for DNA abnormalities, they're looking for RNA abnormalities.
Mm.
These are all just different kinds of genetic material that, becomes aberrant and dysregulated in folks who have colon cancer. So those are all the stool-based tests. And then there are a couple blood tests that have come out. One of them is septin-9. It's methylated DNA fragments that are in the blood that are, that become more prevalent in patients who have colon cancer. And then there's the cell-free DNA testing, which is kind of the new kid, hot new kid on the block. It's really cell-free material that they find in the blood that's more prevalent in folks who have colon cancer.
It sounds like the blood-based and the stool-based test, it almost sounds like, maybe I'm wrong, that by the time you see something abnormal on those, you probably have some pathology going on versus the colonoscopy with a trained eye like yours. You're picking up problems before they become a pathology. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair statement? I don't know.
When you think about all the stool-based tests that we talked about, FIT, mm-hmm. Cologuard, ColoSense, these are pretty good tests when it comes to finding cancer. If you're going about on average, you're probably looking at maybe like a 75 to 85% sensitivity, i.e. what's the chance if I had a positive test, you know, me actually having colon cancer. It's a pretty good test when it comes to colon mm-hmm. cancer, you know, finding colon cancer. But I really want to know not just if it's good at finding colon cancer, but is it good at finding these like advanced adenomas? An advanced adenoma is really, it's a polyp that is showing signs, you know, of having these precancerous, this change from really a polyp to cancer already in it. Because that's really the, you know, the point where if we're able to do your colonoscopy at that point, remove this polyp, then, you know, we've really stopped, you know, the whole cancer tumor genesis sure. pathway. How do those perform with advanced adenomas? They're usually in the low, maybe about 40%, 42%, worse than a flip of a coin. They're not really good as when you think about them in the context of like, you know, I think preventing cancers. The stool blood tests, so far as, you know, I don't know if I'm a little fuzzy on some of the numbers. I know for the cell-free DNA, which I believe is commercially available as the Guardant, I want to say when it comes to finding colon cancer sensitivity, I think it's in like the high 80s.
Okay.
I want to say like 80s, 90s. So pretty good at finding colon cancer. When it comes to advanced adenoma, 13% was the number wow. that I remember. Yeah. So not really good at finding, you know, advanced lesions that you really want to take out before they become cancer. And the other thing just to note, I think in clinic I've seen, you know, because I want to say a lot of these blood tests are just becoming commercially available. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to look and see if, you know, the United States, you know, Preventive Task Force is actually given the green light on them before, you know, because that's really what determines whether or not your insurance company right, is actually right. going to pay for the test that you got sent for. When it comes to the stool test that more folks, you know, come to me, I see a lot of positive Cologuards. We know, right, that if you wait longer than 6 to 9 months after you've had a positive stool test, if we do find a lesion or it is going to be more advanced than if you would come sooner. So sure. mm-hmm. it is really, really important that if you do have a positive test, not as a way to scare folks, but as a way to be prudent, that you really have to start making the steps to get a colonoscopy as soon as you can. And the other thing, these mm-hmm. tests are, they're only for specific patients. The two main things you have to know is that, you know, you really shouldn't be getting these non-invasive tests if, one, if you have a family history of, you know, colon cancer, and two, if you have symptoms, right? If you have belly pains or abnormal bowel habits or character, or the texture of your stool has changed, or, you know, you see intermittently you have a little bit of blood in your stool. I mean, these are really not appropriate tests to be using
sure.
In these kinds of patients.
Well, thank you for this really in-depth overview, going deep in the woods, or deep in whatever, but no, it's, I mean, it's something that's yeah. really necessary. A lot of people are questioning, you know, hey, why, you know, why should I do this? It's a big ask, but by the same yeah. token, it sounds like there's a big, big benefit. Obviously you're well-trained. University of Maryland undergrad, right? Or mm-hmm. medical school, undergrad and yeah. medical school, then Emory University for your residency and fellowship.
Yes.
Give the
yes.
audience an idea of how long is that whole training as far as, you know, after med school, the residency and fellowship for what you do.
Med school, yep, 4 years. And then residency, you do 3 years, you know, mm-hmm. really it's your intern year for 1 year. And then you're really kind of managing teams for your next two.
Sure.
And then fellowship is 3 years. that's the base right there.
Right.
Because you can certainly do programs for advanced positions that'll add an extra year to 2 years.
It's interesting too, looking at the other side or the personal side of folks. I know your background, a lot of cool things come up when you look at you on social media. One is salsa dancer, still doing that, or what was that all about?
I definitely do try to do that a little bit. When I was an undergrad, a couple of my friends kind of just picked it up. One of them was Puerto Rican, and we just ended up joining the salsa team when I was in undergrad, and I kind of just kept doing it, you know, even when I was in med school, you know, at Emory. There's actually a really great community. And what's been nice is, you know, going abroad and getting to dance, you know, the culture is, it's really a different thing, you know, dancing. My older brother, sorry, lives in Medellin, Colombia. Dancing there was incredible. You know, the energy.
Bet, yeah.
Yeah. It's fire.
One other thing that caught my eye too, it says here, retired fencing. Now that's not like fence posts and building fences. That's the actual fencing, right? How did you get into that? Or
you
retired from that now?
I played football when I was in high school, and going to a D1, you know, institution. I decided just to skip tryouts because I didn't think it'd be for me.
Wow.
But I had loved the movie Pirates of the Caribbean, and so I always was interested in, you know, swordplay. Yeah, I ended up joining University of Maryland's fencing team.
Man.
I did fencing for probably the first 3 years that, you know, we were there. So it was actually a ton of fun.
Wow.
My coach, Dave Griffin, he actually was in the Olympics way back when. So he was just, you know, way more intense than I had expected, you know, the whole
Wow.
Bit to be. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Who knew that Johnny Depp and Pirates of the Caribbean could inspire a D1 you know, sports career? That's cool.
Yeah, no, it was a blast.
Well, I know you have a background in podcasting as well, and it certainly shows here. We appreciate you joining us. And again, it is Palmetto primary and specialty care physicians, in this case, a division of gastroenterology. So Dr. Chuma Obinime, thank you so much for joining us here on the HealthLinks podcast.
DJ, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And folks, remember, our podcast do have a video component as well, so make sure you tune into that and watch images and pictures that we might have there. And also, love to hear from you. Reach out with any thoughts you have on any of our guests or perhaps suggestions for future podcasts. You can reach out directly to me at host@healthlinksc.com, and we'll put that down below here as well. So once again, DJ Thatcher, thank you for joining us here on the HealthLinks podcast.